From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. A good night's rest is always important.
Sir, could I trouble you for a glass of warm milk? It helps put me to sleep.
Now you will go to sleep, or I will put you to sleep. Check out the name tag. You're in my world now, Grandma.
Oh, dear.
We all need plenty of rest, including teenagers, right? In the break room, we will talk about a new study which shows teens are more sleep-deprived than ever. The cause? Smartphones. That's ahead, but first, we've spent a lot of time recently talking about guns and why many Southerners carry them.
When I was a little girl, my father taught me how to shoot. I was 8 years old when he first put a gun in my hand.
I own them for hunting. I own them for protection. Matter of fact, I got one in the door of my truck. Somebody comes up right now and wants to start something, I'm putting them where they belong. It's quicker than calling the police.
I am a single woman who lives alone, and I need to be able to protect myself.
And I hope to God that I never, ever have to use it.
And here are more of your first thoughts. Zach Cojone writes from Savannah, I own a handgun purchased after a business owner was murdered near our home. We heard the incident. We hoped they were fireworks. I don't feel that a gun makes one safer, but it makes you feel safer. I do sleep a bit better at home having a gun here, but I still hate it. Nick Boxer in Atlanta writes, I understand why people believe having a gun will make them safe, even though there is overwhelming evidence owning a gun is much more likely to result in harm to the owner or a family member. The issue is that most Americans live anecdotally. They use stories to validate their beliefs. The debate continues civilly and with respect. You can give us a call with your thoughts at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. Okay, as we get started, a reminder to everyone in studio and everyone listening. Fall back this weekend. Fall back. Daylight saving time ends at 2 a.m. on Sunday, so don't forget to set your clocks back before you go to bed. Next Tuesday, Atlanta voters pick a new mayor. With 9 candidates vying for the office, campaign fundraising and robocalls are playing a major role in the race. It's a hot-button issue as the feds investigate pay-to-play contracts at City Hall, a joint investigation by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Georgia News Lab examines the flow of money from city contractors to the campaigns. I'm joined by AJC reporter Dan Kleppel and Georgia News Lab reporter Ryan Basden. Good morning to both of you.
Morning. Morning.
Dan, let me start with you. What was the central question that you wanted an answer to in this investigation?
Right. We wanted to see how much influence contractors and city vendors were having in the election in terms of how much money they were giving to the various candidates. And we thought that was important because of the federal bribery investigation that you referenced earlier.
And absolutely clear at this point, given your years of reporting in this area, that money equals influence?
I think most people would agree with that. Mm. And one of the questions we asked was, how important is money in a local race compared to a statewide race or a national race? And universally, the answer was just as important. You need less of it because there's the election is smaller. There's fewer voters, so there's less ground to cover. But the money buys the same things as it does statewide. You know, television and radio advertising, direct mail, those glossy flyers that fill up your mailbox.
Yeah.
You know, campaign staff and polling and all kinds of things.
Right. Did you think going into the project that there would be actually less money flowing into the mayor's race this cycle because of the investigation that's ongoing?
Well, we weren't sure. And honestly, I don't think anyone's ever quantified the amount of money coming from city vendors and contractors. We were able to do so because we have a database of city payments to city vendors from 2010 to 2014. And so we were able to take, and Ryan was a big part of this, we were able to take campaign finance disclosures and compare it to that database and kind of get a handle on, you know, how much money was coming in.
Hey, Ryan, how good has the campaign finance reporting been in this cycle? Give it a letter grade.
Overall,
you're a student.
Overall, or from the AJC.
Yeah.
Overall, oh gosh, I'd give it an F if I'm honest.
You'd give it an F.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that, and the prime reason is that the way all of these campaign finance reports are actually published and given to the public, or put in a place where the public can access them,
right,
they're not in a form that's readable and even useful by anyone without a skill set that someone at the AJC or someone at the Georgia News Lab might have, a data processing skill set. Or
you need a data processing skill set to be able to understand the forms and what's on the forms, what's not on the forms, in order to access this kind of information?
Or a lot of time on your hands
or
to read.
Or a lot of time.
Yeah, so we would get these reports in the forms of PDFs, and some of these PDFs would be hundreds of pages, and there's 2-3 contributions per page. So unless you have a lot of printer ink and a lot of paper and a lot of room to print all these out and sit and read through them, you're not going to get an idea of who's contributing to who and why. Now, what we had to do was we had to take those PDFs, and if you've ever worked with a PDF, you know that they're not friendly.
It's a nightmare, right?
Right.
It can be.
So we had to take those, and we had to convert those to spreadsheets, and not just spreadsheets, but spreadsheets that we could analyze and pull metrics from, totals. We had to make sense of all of this stuff, and there were 3 to 4 reports minimum per candidate. And when we started, we were looking at 13 or 14
candidates. Isn't there an easier way to do this? Can't you do this electronically?
You can, but it's not easy. Electronic, in this case, does not mean easy.
Does not mean easy. Okay, so I don't want to run out of time before, Dan, we get to some of the findings.
Mm-hmm.
So Ryan and the team are working on the data dive,
right,
the crunching. Mm-hmm. And then you're writing the stories, you're putting all this together. Mm-hmm. What were some of the major findings?
Well, we found that city vendors contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's a conservative figure, hundreds of thousands of dollars to the various candidates.
Why conservative?
Well, because the some
could
of
you
the,
pin it down?
Some of the issues that Ryan was talking about, those campaign finance disclosures quite often were not filled out completely, which limited our ability to connect people with companies that are doing business with the city. If a person donates and doesn't say who their employer is, it's impossible. It's very difficult for us to make that connection unless you know who that individual is and where they work. So, and that's what we were searching for, employers, addresses that matched with an employer. And we're searching through a database of, I think it was 40,000 payments or more from the city to companies. So matching, these people and these companies that donated with companies that did business with the city was a pretty difficult task.
Wow. It doesn't sound like a very difficult thing to do, to fill out a disclosure form properly. So what's going on here? Is it the campaigns not following up with folks who are making donations, companies that are making donations? What's happening here?
I think your mileage varies case to case. Although I will say that a couple of the candidates, Keisha Lance Bottoms comes to mind, had just tremendous amounts of missing information. For example, in her campaign finance reports, we found 20% of her donors did not list an employer. So I think, occasional lapses or occasional blank spots on these PDFs is understandable. But when you have a whole ocean of them, it's more difficult to explain away. And I honestly don't know the reasons for why these forms aren't filled out correctly.
Well, what is required? I guess what I'm asking is, mm-hmm, what is legally required in these filing documents?
Sure. So if you give a donation to a candidate, you're supposed to give your name, your address, your employer's address, and your telephone number. And that's really all we needed to do this analysis.
Well, that's pretty simple.
Well, you would think that a candidate trying to run the city of Atlanta would be able to master campaign finance disclosure reports.
Right. And another way, Ryan, to sort of check what's happening here is through disclosures on expenditures, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what did you find in that area? Were the candidates filling out the expenditure disclosures properly and completely?
In most cases, yes. In a few extreme cases, no. Keisha Lance Bottoms was kind of our serial information.
Okay, so what's happening with Keisha? what's going on here?
So Dan was talking about the about contribution info missing.
Yeah.
That was a problem across the board, I would say. More candidates had that problem than others. One of the things we found with Keisha Lance Bottoms, and this is why I can't attribute the missing data just to people contributing, mm-hmm. is because on her expenditure reports that would come in the same document as the contributions, there would be a purpose field for spending this money. And so there would be entries where she was spending thousands of dollars here, thousands of dollars there. And we would have a company name, but those are ambiguous mm-hmm. a lot. And the purpose field would be completely empty.
Right.
So we have thousands of dollars going in all these different directions. We have no idea why. And so, but there are no contributors responsible for filling out that information, right? That money is it belongs to the campaign. They're spending that money. They know exactly where it's going. They're just not putting it down.
Okay, so Keisha Lance Bottoms is having these problems. Are there other candidates who are having the same issues?
Yeah, I would say we found these types of issues pretty much across the board.
Pretty consistently.
It was just a matter of degree. And like I said, Ms. Lance Bottoms had 20% of her employer fields left empty, and we're talking about thousands of donors. So that one really stood out to us. In fact, we mentioned that in the story. But sure, Mitchell, Norwood, Amon, Woolard, they all, to one degree or another, had issues on their reports.
That's AJC reporter Dan Kleppel, and Georgia News Lab reporter Ryan Bazden is with us as well. Dan, let me ask you this. Are the major candidates promising some kind of reform, procurement reform in as part of their campaign? And if they are, the fact that they're not filling out these forms properly seems to be sending out a bad signal.
It's become a central issue in the campaign, and pretty much every major candidate has talked about the need for procurement reform in terms of how the city does business with contractors. Many have called for an audit of the procurement department. Of course, the U.S. Attorney's Office is doing an audit kind of now with their investigation. So there's no end in sight with the bribery investigation. So,
yeah.
Everybody's talking about it and promising reform.
Based on your research, and this is for both of you, Dan, let me start with you. Based on your research, should we, as a general rule, pay more attention to who is financing these local races, particularly a mayoral race, and the kind of power a mayor in a big city can wield?
Well, we think it's important. This is public information and information that's supposed to be readily available to voters. And so, from my perspective, I don't care if a reader of the AJC thinks it's a good thing or a bad thing that these companies are giving. That's not for me to decide, but I want to make sure that the information's available to them so that they can draw whatever conclusions they want to.
Yeah. Quick word from you on that, Ryan?
Yeah, I would say really the most important part of this is that in order to get the information that we got, I at the Georgia News Lab, I had to write code to extract the information from the
okay, PDFs. So we can,
right.
Yeah.
Not something that the average citizen knows, and that's not at all their fault.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have to know that. That's what we need to be focusing on, right, is that this information is not easily available.
Thank you both. I appreciate it. The AJC reporter Dan Kleppel and Georgia News Lab reporter Ryan Bazden with us. Just ahead, the Break Room gang is with us. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. In the wake of this week's terror attack in New York, President Trump says he wants to kill the diversity visa lottery. It's a program that issues about 50,000 visas a year to countries with low immigration rates to the United States. The president has also said he wants local law enforcement agencies to crack down more on illegal immigration under a program called 287G. This program is not new. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has 287G agreements with 60 law enforcement agencies across the country. They include four Georgia counties where it has been on the books for several years. As On Second Thought producer Sean Powers reports, the program may be expanding in the state.
To see the effects of 287G, look no further than Dalton, Georgia. It's in the northwest part of the state, about 90 minutes from Atlanta. Dalton calls itself the carpet capital of the world for its large carpet and flooring industry that employs thousands of people. That industry has attracted a large number of Mexican immigrants, like Remigio Chavarria.
I came to Dalton looking for a better opportunity for me and my family because at the time I only had my first son. And the situation in Mexico, especially in my hometown, was very difficult with unemployment. And we decided to come here to give them a better life.
Chavarria arrived here in 1994 and works as a machine operator at a carpet factory. The middle-class life he's built for his wife and three children is something he says they couldn't have had in Mexico. But in 2010, the life he spent years to build began to unravel. Chavarria was driving when his vehicle was hit by another driver.
It wasn't my fault. Someone hit my car. I was trying to pass, and the person was trying to pass too. So he hit my car. I told him nothing happened to any of our cars, and we didn't need to call the police. He said he needed to call the police to make his report.
When the police arrived, Chavarria was arrested for not having a license. He spent a couple of days in the county jail, and when an ICE hold was put on him, he was sent to Georgia's Stewart Detention Facility, where immigrants awaiting deportation hearings are held. Because Whitfield County is part of the 287G program, sheriff's deputies are trained in immigration law and can use a federal database to check immigration status. But ICE spokesman Brian Cox says that doesn't mean an officer's arrest power is expanded.
For a criminal violation, which has nothing to do with their immigration status, local law enforcement is only empowered to enforce state law, local law. So 287G, in very blunt terms, does not give any authority to arrest a person based on their immigration status.
I contacted the four sheriff's departments in Georgia who have had training with ICE under 287G. The only one to respond with a comment was Whitfield County Sheriff Scott Chitwood. His email statement says he joined 287G about a decade ago to cut down on crime. Chitwood declined an interview request, but he did speak with Georgia Public Broadcasting earlier this year.
We had a lot of individuals that started coming into the community that was working in the carpet mills, and there became a much concern of a potential criminal element that comes with people from out of town.
Immigration activist America Gruner of Dalton says when the Whitfield County Sheriff's Office began enforcing the 287G program about a decade ago, many immigrants in this community were being arrested and deported, often for minor crimes. She remembers seeing police roadblocks set up.
Those were the gates for being deported because every person that didn't have a license, they were sent to the county jail. So the roadblocks was the first step to be deported. Are you working?
Yes.
How much are you making per week or month?
Per week, mm-hmm. I made like around 800.
I met up with America Gruner in her Dalton office. She was there helping a resident from Chatsworth named Jesus Guzman with his DACA application. That's deferred action for childhood arrivals. Guzman says he knows many people in the area who have been deported.
I go to church. In our church, I met many people that now they know here, because they've been deported. That made me feel so sad because many of my friends, now they don't have either their mom or daddy with them. I was afraid that can happen to me too.
Jesus Guzman admits that for a long time before DACA, he drove without a license to get to work, but managed to never get in trouble. America Gruner says that fear of being caught without a license affects many people in the area. She says she understands why that would convince some families to leave the community, but she tells them to stay.
We have met with taxi companies to tell them to charge less or to take a group. And we have also gotten volunteers to drive people around. So it's what we tell the people, and not to be paralyzed by fear, but be aware and be careful.
Azadeh Shashahani is the legal and advocacy director of the Atlanta-based social justice group Project South. She says the 287G program unfairly targets certain people.
So you have this deportation pipeline from all four 287G jails right now, which has led to large numbers of deportations from these counties, as well as, I would say, racial profiling.
Others, like the American Immigration Council and the American Civil Liberties Union, agree that 287G leads to racial profiling. ICE says it tracks arrest data in communities that are approved for 287G and looks for signs of inconsistencies. The agency claims it hasn't seen any red flags yet. Whitfield County Sheriff Scott Chitwood says his officers don't target law-abiding citizens or law-abiding immigrants who are in the country illegally.
I feel like that people that are of foreign-born almost know the law better than we do. They know what they are and aren't doing. You know, and realistically, if they stay under the radar, yeah, you probably could stay in this country for 100 years and never be caught. But once you violate the law and it's a jailable offense, now we can go to step 2, 3, and 4 and check in this additional database.
But even someone flagged by ICE because of 287G wouldn't necessarily be deported under the Obama administration. Immigrants who are undocumented were considered a deportation priority if they met certain criteria, like being in a gang, having a felony conviction, or several misdemeanors. Simply being arrested for a minor traffic violation wasn't necessarily grounds to be kicked out of the country. ICE spokesman Brian Cox says under the Trump administration, any person arrested who is undocumented is considered a deportation priority. He told me that includes people who were picked up under 287G years ago but were allowed to stay in the U.S.
So the only real change is that ICE officers are now looking at each specific case on its individual merits to make a determination.
And that includes older cases plus newer cases, where somebody is maybe detained as of today or detained 5, 6 years ago.
Could be, absolutely. Depending on the specific circumstances, it could apply to both.
And that worries some people with immigration violations from years ago. We met Ramijo Chabarria at the beginning of this story. He's the machine operator at the carpet factory in Dalton. The circumstances surrounding his traffic arrest and immigration detention in 2010 came back to haunt him this year, even though he was able to bond out of immigration detention and get a work permit.
Porque ya yo tuve una orden.
I already had a supervision order, similar to probation, where you need to check in with your officer. Last time I checked, they said since all my options were denied and my appeal was denied, I had to leave the country by September the 14th.
When we spoke in August, he was a month away from returning to Mexico, leaving behind his wife and 3 children. His wife, Araceli Landeros, says she is trying to help their children get through this.
Para mí esto es muy duro porque mis hijos están sufriendo mucho.
This is really hard for me because my children are suffering a lot. The little one is handling it a bit better because she went through therapy. I've asked the older one to be more mature and think about her dad not going to another country. He's going to his country with his head held up because he's not a criminal. He came to this country to provide a better future for them and me.
The Trump administration says the 287G program serves the nation well. In Georgia, ICE says 4 additional counties have applied to join 287G. For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you want sheriff's deputies in your community doing more to enforce immigration laws? You can call us and leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. Hey, it has been a long week, and we've talked about guns, went ghost hunting, and discussed some theoretical physics. Oh, my. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a really smart group of people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for the break room.
White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is again facing criticism for some controversial remarks. This time, it's for comments he made about the Civil War and Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Hey, your hands are freezing.
Okay, and joining us in the break room are Tomika DePriest. She is Senior Director of Marketing at Emory University. Ed Sohn, Vice President of the media company Thomson Reuters. Simon Bloom, constitutional attorney. We will need you in a couple of segments here. In the Bloom Sugarman Law Firm, an actor and comedian. London Brown is with us. You may know him best from the HBO series Ballers. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the top line name on that show, right?
That's the guy.
He's the guy. He performs here in Atlanta at the Punchline tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Break Room.
Happy Friday.
Oh, happy Friday to each and every one of you. Let's get started. Boy, we've got a lot of topics here that need your thoughts, your feedback. A Cobb County elementary school has ended its traditional Civil War dress-up event after a kid dressed as a plantation owner said, "You are a slave, you are my slave," to a black student. Here's Corey Davis, the student's mother, talking to the Associated Press.
So my son said he just walked away and talked to some of his other friends, and he just sort of internalized that. You never reenact activities where there's a power dynamic, where there was a struggle of oppression. Simulating that means that when this activity is over, what are the children left to think about?
All right, Tomika, let me start with you on this one. Was there a good way to do this, or was it always destined to go badly here?
Well, in my opinion, it's par for the course. I mean, why do people think there was a civil war? It was a fight to maintain slavery. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to me to think about the parameters for that age group that you might put on it to keep it from going wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Ed, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, is it an idea that has outlived its time?
I think that, you know, something like that, a reenactment at that age, it requires a certain amount of nuance to really, and reflection, to grasp, you know, the gravity of what's happening there. And that's not going to happen at that kind of young, impressionistic age. At some point, we do have to trust disruptive expressions, and that's important. And that reenactment, it has value and merit.
Disruptive expressions?
You know, I think that if there is some type of enactment that's trying to express that power dynamic in some way, there is certainly an audience for that, where we need to be confronted with the reality of that. But that's not a 10-year-old at an elementary school, certainly not.
Simon, what was your reaction when you read this piece?
It was destined for failure. With the age context, and we don't know all the facts, and we don't know all the contours and the parameters that were put around the exercise. I think an exercise that explores the Civil War and tries to derive lessons from it,
there's some value to that?
And understand the history, there's absolutely some value to it. It's our history. It's the nation's history, like it or not. That's our history.
Yeah. London, your thoughts when you heard about the story?
I think that what makes it interesting is that if people don't know the history of it well enough, then, you know, you go into these things kind of aloof, and you're like, well, it's not that bad. I just, you know, just a costume. And it gets dismissed if they don't really understand the undergird of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I want to sneak another one in here before we hit a break here. A new service is providing a number you can give to a guy or a woman who won't stop pestering you, right? You go to a lounge or bar or whatever else, you're hanging out with your friends, and someone is after you for a number. What happens is you give this person the number to get them to move on, right? And when they text that number, they get a response turning them down in no uncertain terms. I'll read what the text says in a moment here. It's called the Mary Sue. Ed, what do you think of the service? Something you'd use?
So here's the thing about that service, right? Here, my problem with the service is that, excuse me, it seems a little gimmicky. I mean, if you need a vehicle to kind of be passive aggressive and put off somebody like that, I mean, it's a good tool. It's a good idea. It's also got mechanical problems. I work in technology, and that number actually is just the one number. So you can use it once. But then if that guy saves that into his phone and says, like, okay, this is the creepster text response or whatever, the next time someone else tries to use it and gives out that number again, it's going to come up as if it's in his phone book as fake creepster deterrent hotline.
Oh, I see.
He's going to be like, oh, I get it. And then you got an awkward situation in that moment when you've just tried to give him a fake number.
It's going to be awkward either way. I'm totally fine with that. I wish women back when I was single and my wife's listening would have just said, hey, I'm not interested, and move on. Then I don't sit idly by with bated breath at the phone waiting for it to ring.
Well, sometimes, you know, women do try that, but persistence, some people have learned or think that persistence pays off. Yeah. And so as I think about this service, if I have a creeper, I'm calling the police.
Right.
It's that simple for me. And in terms of whether or not I will use the service, no. I'm just going to say no and keep it moving.
London, what are your thoughts?
Honestly, guys don't mind a woman being kind of creepish, not stalkerish. But if she can, because creep borderline is also on the line of like, you know what? I know we ain't met before, but if we can, you know, it's not so bad sometimes as a guy. Because guys, you know, we creeps sometimes. So we're like, you know,
you
I don't
mind a girl creep on you.
I don't mind a creep,
right?
To a degree. Be clean. That's all I'm
saying. And be clean. Okay, it's Friday, and we're in the break room just ahead. Taking smoke breaks, big implosions, and Robert E. Lee. That's next on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do each Friday. And my guests today are Tomika DePriest, Senior Director of Marketing at Emory University, Ed Sohn, Vice President of the media company Thomson Reuters, Simon Bloom, constitutional attorney at the Bloom Sugarman Law Firm, and actor and comedian London Brown is with us. He is performing at the Punchline here in Atlanta tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. Okay, more bad news for President Trump. He is named Paul Manafort.
President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was charged with conspiracy against the United States. Yeah, apparently his conspiracy against the United States was suggesting to Donald Trump that he run for president.
Okay, so are you clear on the Russia investigation? I guess is the overarching question here. If not, you're certainly not alone. Now, for many, the whole thing is pretty convoluted. It certainly feels confusing at times and weighty, of course. Are you still following what's going on? Simon, look, let me come to you on this. How big a deal will this turn? We're talking about, in one case, a guilty plea. And two other cases, we're talking about indictments. How big a deal is this? How big a turn is this in the investigation?
It's a major turn for the two guys that have just been indicted. It's a political turn for Donald Trump. But from a legal standpoint, the Manafort indictments are very specific, and they all deal with conduct up into and not past 2014. So there's no actual attachment to the 2016 campaign, which was the purpose of the Mueller mandate as special counsel. He was mandated to investigate and to pursue crimes that were arising out of this election. And what he's done is he's gone deeper and wider and expanded his own breadth, which is a dangerous precedent all of itself. But from a political standpoint, does it make Trump look bad that he had guys that were potentially laundering money, $12 million worth of money that came from the Ukraine? Yeah, it looks bad.
Do you see a route that leads further up the food chain, that ultimately could ensnare more people, more senior people in the Trump administration?
Not from this indictment.
Not from this.
If Mueller had that data, if he had those facts, if he had that evidence, by God, you know it would have been in this indictment coming into the 2016 campaign.
Ed, do you think that there is some squeezing going on here, that he's working up the food chain?
I don't know the answer to that. I will say that, you know, I appreciate the approach of following the channels. I agree that there's a dangerous precedent in terms of expanding the scope, but an indictment requires a certain amount of evidence. That evidence, you know, they felt like they met that threshold. And compare this to, for instance, like the actions of like James Comey, who just had random press conferences and was saying, or press releases saying that like, oh, we're investigating this. This is actually a legal document that, you know, meets at some level, you know, some prima facie kind of burden of proof, right? Some basic elements. And I think that that's meaningful, because if you have that and you are entrusted with investigating this whole situation, you can't not bring those charges also.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be my argument.
Does the guilty plea from George Papadopoulos suggest to you that there may be that Mueller may be working on the collusion side through Papadopoulos.
There's no question that Mueller is trying to find the collusion aspect or the Russian involvement in the 2016 campaign and the election. That's obvious. But finding the evidence that establishes it and connects it to Trump and or his people is another thing entirely. And I don't think he's going to stop until he feels like he's exhausted all that analysis and all those resources.
Yeah, I think the name of the game is how can we turn others, right? How can we use these indictments
to leverage
and connect to others? I know Hope Hicks, his close aide, is on the list next. And we'll have to see what the outcome is with that.
London, what do you, as you look at everything that's unfolding here, right? This investigation, how do you see it? How do you view it? What are your thoughts on it at this point?
I think as you get on a certain platform, you start to form your team. I think you need to go to a Starbucks or a Chick-fil-A, wherever you need to go.
Okay.
And say, look, let's have some sandwiches and listen. Make everybody feel very comfortable, very, very relaxed. If you got anything that we need to know about moving forward, let's just go on and put it out there. Get it all out there. We can figure out and let's adjust it. So then we go out there in the media and people start pulling out all these things out of your closet. You say, you know what, Eddie? Hey, we've already addressed that.
Right.
He got this and that, and we can just walk forward.
And you don't feel that has been done adequately to this point?
Not yet.
Not to this point.
Things are coming out of everywhere. It's like people are digging in their pocket. Hey, man, here's this.
I forgot about this meeting. I didn't mention this meeting.
Dude, just get your
team. Yeah, I know a couple of Russians, even though I said I didn't know a couple
of
Russians.
But you know what? Front and move forward.
But you know what? Manafort is fired. And one would think that it's partially because of that, right? And I agree. Vetting, super basic. Right. Why would you not do that? One would think that Manafort was fired for a reason. What doesn't make sense is the continued support that's coming from the Trump administration for this character. Mm-hmm. That's what doesn't make sense to me.
Well, he has no choice at that point. Otherwise, he's self-indicting. He has to defend to some extent and deflect like he did with his text or his tweet rant this morning at 3:57 a.m.
Oh, gosh, I didn't see that. Yeah. Okay, a show of hands. I know that's terrible for radio. Of our break room gang with children. Show of hands. London, you're yeah.
Okay. I don't have any kids.
Okay. And Tamika, okay, great. When kids don't get enough sleep, bad things, I'm told, start to happen.
He was sent to in-school suspension for refusing to take a test, and then he fell asleep in in-school suspension.
I've just been tired. I've been working late. And
where are you working right now?
More like pulling out trees.
At midnight?
It takes all day to pull out a big stump, dude.
Okay, so new research says teens are more sleep deprived than ever, and smartphones are the villains. Let's go to the parents here of young people. Do your teens seem to need more sleep? What's the solution here, Ed?
So my teen is actually 1 year old, and we try to limit his screen time. It's true. He sleeps great all night long. I will say,
how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, I would say, you know. The interesting thing, the kind of counterpoint to this study is that I remember a few years ago, and it felt really justifying and really vindicating that teens hormonally actually, they just are later sleepers and later risers. It's actually something that's built into like a shift in the circadian rhythm.
Huh?
So smartphones might be a culprit and blue light and all that kind of stuff. But I actually read that there's several studies now that show that teens into kind of the early college years, they're wired kind of fundamentally, biologically, to sleep late and wake up late. So I'm all about that. That explains my entire freshman year in college, is what I'm saying.
I need to understand the whole blue light thing a little better because I'm struggling with this myself. But Simon, what are your thoughts on this? You have a teen?
I can't speak to the teen years other than the ones I experienced, which didn't have cell phones. But my six-month-old Betsy Bloom is a social media champion already. But there's a simple solution to this, and that's simply to take the phone away at bedtime. I mean, if we were really worried about the things that you and I did when we were kids on the phone.
I can't put my phone down.
Boom.
You got to sleep.
Right?
Yeah.
I can't put my computer away. I can't put my phone down.
I can.
You can.
This problem with teens isn't just limited to teens.
Right.
I mean, so the adults in society have this issue
as
well.
And in this room.
And when I was a teen, my mom just took the phone when she caught me late one night on it. And so, you know, just about 11 o'clock every night, she'd come and collect it, take it to their bedroom.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't see it again until the next day.
Right.
Yeah.
London, it's.
Yeah.
I think it's a, well, it's a problem, right?
It is serious. Like, that's the thing. The core of it is that we all, most of us can't put our phones down, but the reasons why is different. If I'm with a woman, I can't. If I don't quite trust her, I got to sleep with my phone.
Stop.
It's those kinds of things where I'm like, I can sleep. The phone isn't the problem. It's the person I'm with that makes me uncomfortable. But I feel like we are attached.
Are we back to the creepy segment? Yeah, is that where we are now?
You should give her this fake phone number. I heard it works really good.
I got a fake phone number. But I feel like, you know, sometimes you just want to, it's always about just want to get the last reply.
Yes.
Just want to, and you'll be up. I've done it. I've been up extra hours just trying to say goodnight.
No, you hang up.
Gotcha.
You hang up.
All right, so here's, I want your reaction to this. Here's White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, describing General Robert E. Lee during a recent Fox News interview.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state.
Now, he also said the Civil War happened because both sides couldn't compromise. The reaction was both fierce and immediate. Simon, what is this? A failure to compromise. So that's the reason there was a Civil War.
Yeah, he's got the history wrong there. And we have to look at several elements of what he said in order to be able to make any kind of judgment about what he's saying. And I'm very, very sensitive to historic relativism. And that is the danger of imposing our current day morality on things that people did. If we're going to take the position that someone was a bad person or that something was morally oppositional, that's one thing. He's wrong on the history. The North and the South tried to compromise for years. They negotiated for years before the secession occurred. And there was simply an uncompromisable issue for the South, and that was the ownership of slavery, of slaves.
Yeah.
And that was not a position that could be compromised. It's pretty clear that the line was drawn in the sand, and then hundreds of thousands of Americans lost their lives as a result.
Yeah. Ed, what was your reaction when you heard this?
I mean, setting aside just the insane sensitivities on this topic and the general good judgment to not open your yap on it, it feels like, absolutely, he was wrong. That's revisionist history. But I do think that wars are started for a lot of factors that don't come out in history books. And like, that's worth being objective about. Mm-hmm. You know, I agree with not imposing morality retrospectively, but the only compromise that would have obviated the Civil War is if the South said, yeah, abolition is cool with us. Like then, right. And they ratified that in the Constitution. That is the only compromise that would have averted the Civil War.
And Tamika, he kind of stepped into it. I don't think there's any other way around that. We can probably all agree on that.
Yeah, he did. I think that sort of reflects what happens in society. I mean, we need to have these conversations, and we need to understand why the Civil War happened. I mean, there's a lot of different thoughts that emanate, but it all goes back to enslavement and property ownership. But for some reason, we dance around that. I know why.
Well,
it's difficult. It's painful. But we have to face the pain and move forward.
Yeah.
And I'm 100% on board with using it like we did with the Cobb County example, using the Civil War as a platform to have the difficult discussions around race relations in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. What I am very careful about and warn against is making moral judgments about people that participated on one side of the line or the other 120 years ago.
Okay.
But that's what tends to happen. I mean, if you think about Martin Luther King and the whole moral compass, I mean, that actually was the argument in terms of abolitionist movement during that period. So I don't think you're going to be able to separate morality
from
the situations.
So, Lyndon, I'm going to come to you on this one. Netflix has canceled A House of Cards after news of star Kevin Spacey's alleged sexual harassment of a then 14-year-old. He has issued an apology during which he came out as gay. Some see this as a timely deflection. What would you like to see happen to the Netflix series? I guess it's being canceled. That's one thing. And then what should happen to Kevin Spacey? You're in that world of being in series work. You know what it means to have a show canceled and what that means for everyone connected to that production.
Right.
Your thoughts on the show being canceled by Netflix, and then what should happen to Kevin Spacey?
I think that Kevin Spacey's going to be fine. That's the first thing. Why? Because it's set up this way. You know, there's some things culture, and I have friends who say, you know, London, come on, London, everything isn't about race. I'm like, you're in denial. It is the fabric of the country.
And you think he's going to be okay because
he's going to be okay
because he's white.
He's a white guy. He'd be fine. Don't get me wrong. He's dope. He's a dope actor. He's very talented. But the way it's set up, he's going to have the support that he's going to need.
Right.
And he has the skills to stay in there. But the system and the way it's set up, he'll be fine.
Yeah, and Tamika, you think he's going to be fine?
I actually do. You think agree. Down the line he will be.
He'll be able to weather this and continue his career. And
I'm going to compare and look at, even though Bill Cosby is at the end of, you know, he's much older than Kevin Spacey. But let's watch the two and see what happens.
Simon, what are your thoughts?
Well, Harvey Weinstein's not going to be fine.
No.
And he's white as the day and the sunshine. And I don't think I don't think it has much, if anything, to do with race in this regard. If you are that wealthy and that powerful and that well-noted and well-respected for your trade, and you do something stupid or illegal in this case, you should face the consequences one way or the other. And I hope that if, in fact, he did something illegal, that he is prosecuted the way anyone else, white or black, yellow or green, would be prosecuted.
Yeah.
And I think that he will be, and you're seeing that. I think you're seeing that throughout the industry.
Let me jump ahead to one more. Let me see if I can squeeze one more topic in here. The implosion of the Georgia Dome is set for November 20th.
4, 3, 2.
All right, here comes the implosion.
Implosion? But I thought you said...
Tamika, are you interested in this at all? You can't go and see it live. You got to watch it on television.
No.
No?
No. I am not.
Why? Don't you like to see big things go boom?
No, it's like watching. For me, it's like watching paint dry on the wall. I mean, it's boring after probably the first couple seconds.
Ed, big thing goes boom.
I have not been to the new stadium. I heard it's amazing. I definitely
what
look forward to going to a game
on
there.
Here?
But you know what? I am kind of against this kind of symbolic destruction of stadiums as disposable. I don't think that that's right. I think that could have been repurposed. I live near Turner Field. I don't think it's right that the Braves left. I've been to a new game in SunTrust Park. I hear the new stadium is great, but like, think about the waste. You know, the implosion is just going to be like this gigantic symbol of the waste of the Georgia Dome.
Simon, help me here. I kind of want to see the big thing go boom, but
Well, you were also probably up in the North Georgia mountains for the eclipse. I didn't make the trip up there. It's not as important to me. I don't have a political objection to it being destroyed. I don't feel any impulsion to run down there and watch it. The new stadium is great. But from my standpoint, I'm not much of a voyeur.
Right.
And this is really about voyeurism.
London, quickly.
As a photographer, I like the shots. But guys are guys. We like mud. So seeing something go bang, boom is exciting.
We are out of time in the break room today. Thanks to all of my guests, Tamika DePriest, Senior Director of Marketing at Emory University, Ed Sohn. He's a vice president for the media company Thomson Reuters. Simon Bloom is a constitutional attorney for the Bloom Sugarman Law Firm. Actor and comedian London Brown has been with us. You can catch him this weekend at The Punchline. And that is all of our time for On Second Thought. Have a great weekend. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee.